This part of the story begins with John talking. Anna will take over about halfway through. Anna looked rested and remarkably good. I thought maybe the worst was over, that the other things were just her way of settling into this old house and paying homage to those who had come before us. It was such a relief. But then I guess I would have believed anything at that point, just because I wanted so badly for the weirdness and the sickness to end. What a fool I was. I asked Anna if she wanted to get up and go watch the sunset. I had already packed a picnic. She asked how much time she had to get ready, and I told her about 15 minutes, or we'd miss the best colors. She wanted to wash her face and change her clothes, since she'd been sleeping in them all afternoon. In about 5 minutes, I heard Anna running down the stairs and through the dining room. "Race you to the car," she yelled, rushing into the kitchen. She sounded great, and suddenly it seemed that the weekend might be salvaged after all, in spite of the rocky start at lunch. The picnic basket was full of crackers and cheese and apple slices. There were 2 splits of champagne that Anna had picked up at the grocery, and 2 slices of bread pudding with raisins from breakfast. Anna was a terrific cook, even if lately most of her creations were odd and straight out of the pages of the 1917 Wife's Best Companion cookbook we had picked up at an auction. I turned, smiling in the direction of her voice, and stopped cold. Anna was wearing a long white skirt and a pleated blouse with a lace collar and sleeves that gathered just below the elbow. A white net of some sort held her long hair like a pouch and was tied tightly at the nape of her neck with a ribbon. She carried a shawl over her arm. "In case it gets chilly," she said. I looked into her eyes, and before I could take a breath, I knew. It wasn't Anna who looked back at me. I don't remember the picnic or the sunset. Once, not long ago, when we talked about all the events that unfolded in our life, John asked me about that afternoon. I didn't believe it had even happened until he showed me a photo of us that he took that day. He had braced the camera on the picnic table, focused it, and set the shutter for a time release. "You can see the pier in the background. I'm grinning happily." He was right. I wasn't there. The gardens looked great that summer. On Saturday mornings, John liked to sit on the front step with a cup of coffee and watch me weed. Entertainment comes easily in our small town. We had worked magic with those neglected beds, and there were flowers everywhere. Morning glories grew thickly up a wooden lattice arch we put over the walkway. Roses bloomed in pinks and reds, and a circle of cannas stood nearly 5 feet tall in the side yard. There were herb beds outside the kitchen door, and a cottage garden with cleomes and foxglove and cosmos flanking the front entrance. New bridal wreath spirea bushes softened the corners of the porch. I had planted them right where the walking tours of Carlston brochure said they used to be. I knew they would eventually grow to 6 or 7 feet tall and be covered with white blossoms in the spring, just as they probably were decades earlier, before they became old-fashioned and were pulled out to make way for stylish but boring boxy evergreens. John was amazed we'd accomplished so much in less than a year. He asked one Saturday if I knew why no one had planted anything around the house in decades. I hadn't a clue. It's true that the soil was sandy because we were so close to the lake, but I could compensate by heaping on lots of peat and mulch. The maples cast a lot of shade, but overcoming that just took a little resourcefulness and some creativity to figure out what grew without a lot of sun. It wasn't so hard. I look back now and wonder why I never questioned this apparent gardening talent of mine. Though I always said I had a passion for gardening, until we moved into Maple Hill, the biggest patch of ground I'd worked was a window box. I was so happy there, kneeling in the soil, knees cushioned by a piece of foam rubber, a cultivator in one hand, and a pruning shears in the other. Dig deeper. I looked at John to see if he had heard it too. He had turned back to the newspaper and seemed undisturbed. I let it pass. The cold had left my ears plugged and ringing, and sometimes the combination seemed to translate as words on the wind. I heard a lot of things these days. Suggestions, usually. Most often when I was alone and tired, which was most of the time. It felt foolish, but sometimes I tried talking back. Once I thought I yelled too forcefully. I felt my breath knocked out of me, and I fell backward into the side of the couch as though I'd been hit in the chest. I wasn't injured, just perplexed and exhausted. So I went upstairs and took a nap. I knew John worried about me, and I thought it best not to tell him about the incident. I know now we were both keeping things from each other.